Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Sean O'Driscoll, General Manager, Community Support Services, and MVP Program Worldwide. Sean is a world-leading authority on social networking, community engagement, innovation, and the top-ranking speaker and thought leader. Sean, with your exhaustive research into global communities, business, and societal transformation, and your significant contributions to the industry over a sustained and successful career, we thank you for taking the time to do this interview.
Well, I think you've set the bar pretty high already, so hopefully I can live up to some of those expectations and share some of what I've actually learned, probably more from people like you around the world that I've had pleasure of talking to about communities and social media trends and influencer programs and the like with you and your listeners to this interview.
Sean, I found your extensive research and thought leadership into business and societal transformation exciting and intriguing. What are the catalysts for your work?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I've been at Microsoft since about 1992, and 5 years ago I had the opportunity to change roles and take a leadership position focused on connecting with what we call, and you know well, our most valuable professionals, which are essentially community leaders around the world, both online and offline, who volunteer tremendous amounts of their energy, passion, and technical knowledge around our products to helping users use our technology. Now, little did I know at the time how much that work 5 years ago would intersect with this emerging trend of social computing or citizen journalism or Web 2.0 by any other name. And, you know, I guess I've found for me a very strong interest in the connection that's happening between companies like ours and the brands and products that we represent, passionate users who have knowledge and expertise around the product, how we create listening systems around product feedback and the emerging trends of word-of-mouth marketing and people thinking through how do we inspire more conversations about our products, and my own background in the reality is, you know, I'm not a computer scientist. I didn't come to Microsoft because I wanted to write code. I actually studied philosophy in school and consider myself more of a sociologist and anthropologist than computer scientist. So all these things are converging in some really fun ways for me personally, and it's great that it can connect to my professional life as well.
So what is social media, and why should we care?
Well, it's a great question, and everyone will give you probably a host of different definitions, whether it's Web 2.0 or social media or social networking or social computing. Everybody talks about these things differently, and many people define them essentially by how they instantiate on the web. So, for example, many people might describe it as Facebook, or it's discussion boards, or it's wikis, or it's user-generated content, or it's the conversation, maybe one of the more philosophical answers, which in theory I should like. But to me, you know, most of those definitions don't resonate all that well because they don't translate. They're not as visceral or as easy to kind of touch and grab. And so I kind of like to use an analogy to think through what really is social media. So, for example, here in Seattle every year we have an event called Bumper Shoot. Bumper Shoot's a three-day essentially festival held in downtown Seattle. It attracts a few hundred thousand people, and it's full of live music performances and artists and food, and it's a wonderful event that is probably one of the signature events in Seattle every year. Many communities have similar kinds of large-scale events, but I imagine what it would be like to go to Bumper Shoot and be the only attendee, right? The music would be the same, the food would be the same, the art would be the same, but the experience would be radically different than what I know and love about going to a Bumper Shoot event, because what makes Bumper Shoot powerful and exciting is all the other people that are there at the same time as me who care about similar things, and my ability to connect with them in ways that kind of share patterns for things that we're interested in, whether it's the music or the art or the food or just connecting with one another because we do share these same passions. And that's sort of a great metaphor, I think, for the transformation happening via social media on the web, is most Web 1.0 experiences are essentially like being the only attendee at Bumper Shoot. Any website today on the web has the benefit of having tens or hundreds or hundreds of thousands or millions, depending on its scale, of concurrent users at any one time. The problem with most of those websites is that you can't see all of that co-presence, is all those other users are invisible to you. You can't understand what they're there to do. So they end up feeling very lonely. No matter how good your UI design work is, the experience actually feels quite lonely. It's one of the things that I actually do think is a great practice that Facebook uses is the idea of news feeds that kind of gives me that dynamic information about other people in my network and what they're doing. And you can imagine how this might apply to a business like Microsoft when we think about our support scenarios. So when a customer might come to support.microsoft.com, I think many users, you know, inherently they don't really like going to support websites because they may not find their answer in the first place. Secondly, they might feel like they're failing to even go to the website. But frankly, I think we could deliver a dramatically different experience if you had visibility into all the other users that are there at the same time and ability to connect with them, to share your knowledge and expertise with them, to connect on common areas of interest, or to focus conversations or even to develop community within that conversation because you do have share a common profession, perhaps, for example, IT professionals. And so I think that's one of those great ways to kind of think about this transformation. I don't really necessarily think any of this is new, by the way. I mean, I think that's the other great trap in all these wonderful semantics of social media and social web and Web 2.0. You know, cavemen collaborated with one another via word of mouth. You know, it started well before the web. I think what the web is doing today is essentially enabling what is already a very natural human construct, that we want to collaborate with one another. We want to connect and leverage each other's knowledge, skills, and expertise. And what we're seeing now is just a very rapid change to the enablement of that at mass scale in the world around us.
In your many talks, you reference things like Wikonomics or swarm theory, Gowron, Gen Y, and generational change. Which facets do you find the most compelling and why?
Yeah, I mean, all of these things are kind of swirling around right now and driving some interesting occurrences on the web. And it's actually kind of, it's probably the confluence of all of them that I think is, you know, setting up this perfect storm, if you will, that makes it interesting. You know, let me start with Gen Y, I guess, as one part of this. You know, I'm 37 years old, so that kind of makes me old in some respects in the industry and young in some respects in the industry, depending on your particular point of view. But, you know, in all rights, I'm kind of a middler. You know, all this cool social media out there, things like Twitter and Bounce and even Facebook or MySpace, there are days I look at it and I think, boy, I'm just too old to get this stuff. But at the same time, you know, I've made a big effort to invest and try to understand why it's important. The reality is over the next 5 to 10 years, there will be a huge influx of new workers entering the workforce. And those workers bring with them a very different work style, a work style that is really essentially states that email is outdated. Even instant messaging is a little bit outdated to this inbound audience. And they're kind of living in a very flat, non-hierarchical world where ideas move very quickly from person to person and collaboration is very real time. And that's really not the way most large corporations are organized. We're organized in ways that are hierarchical. You know, another person I like is Thomas Friedman. He wrote the book, The World is Flat. And I wrote a blog post a few months ago that said, yeah, the world is flat, but is your company? Because most companies inherently have hierarchies in how they do decision analysis and prioritization. And so I think it'll be very interesting as this workforce enters into corporations. You can almost imagine, you know, a 22-year-old entering a large company today and having a great idea and thinking, well, I should be able to set up a meeting with the CEO next week and go in and pitch my idea. And that would be sort of the normal way things would work. And I think as a 37-year-old, I kind of have two ways to respond to that. I can sit back and think, well, you know, how naive. You know, well, let's work on breaking his spirit by the end of next week and show him that, you know, process is important here. Or I can step back and say, you know what, there's something wrong with the current model, and there's something really powerful about the emergent model. And I think most people actually respond in the negative, not necessarily explicitly, but implicitly, because it's what we've been ingrained with. And I think what's really important is for us to understand that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in how this new work style will affect the workplace, but there is no uncertainty about the fact that it will. And I think as participants in this sea change to social media, I think we have an obligation to kind of understand what that might look like. Swarm theory is fascinating. You know, I read a lot about Web 2.0, and, you know, sometimes I like distractions, so I picked up National Geographic last summer, and, of course, the article I read was Swarm Theory, which is all about, you know, how swarms occur in nature, ants and birds and fish, and how the norms and behaviors of those groups are managed within the group. And, you know, one of the statements in the article that I liked was that, you know, if you look at an ant on the sidewalk, there's pretty much nothing more inane than that. I mean, they don't seem to have any clear purpose. But we've all seen, you know, video or other things of tens of millions of ants in a jungle and the amazing things that they can accomplish. And the notion of swarms is extremely powerful. It actually ties nicely into what Don Tapsco talked about in Wikonomics, in that there will always be more smart people outside your organization on any problem than inside your organization. The historical business problem is you could never actually tap into all that knowledge and expertise in an efficient way for it to participate in the innovation process. And that's what's really changing, I think, with a lot of social media and these social technology tools, is the ability to tap into that natural swarming that people have around ideas and innovation and truly make it a part of an outside-in-driven innovation process for a company. And that has all kinds of amazing byproducts for a brand, whether it's not just the obvious of you might build better products that are more aligned with what your users want, but your users start to feel a sense of maternity or participation in that product innovation. And as we'd all expect, people who feel a sense of ownership for something have much stronger characteristics around their likelihood to recommend the product, their ability to defend the product in public, and that's a great outcome. In fact, that's sort of the dream outcome of any brand manager or any product manager, would be that sort of characteristic. But to do it right, you have to create an environment that enables those external influencers to genuinely participate in setting direction for your product innovation. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
You know, you referenced Don Tapscott and Wikonomics. Can you build that out further in terms of your thoughts on his work?
Yeah, I mean, he wrote, you know, one of the more interesting books as far as I'm concerned, especially the first 100 pages, because I think he just really captured the analogy well of how to think about this notion of group intelligence or co-learning or co-production, right? Are there sort of the buzzwords around this? But, you know, I guess to make it a little bit more real, at Microsoft, one of the ways we think about this is, you know, take the MVP program, for example. You have a group of extremely passionate users around our products who talk about our products a lot in online communities, in the blogosphere, and news groups, and their local user groups. But the reality is they don't talk about our products because we want them to. They talk about the products because they use them and they have passion for them and they want to help other people be successful with them. That's not the effort that they're doing to help Microsoft. They're doing it to help other users. So as we think about these principles of co-production or Wikonomics, I think the business challenge for us is how do we do a better job of enabling the voice of those influencers inside our product development processes so that, you know, we're not just connecting in the beta phase. You know, anybody who understands the product life cycle for a software company would probably tell you that by beta, your features are set. You're really just essentially improving the quality of the code. You're not doing real functional change at that state. So, you know, in the 2-3 years ago where most software companies were really aggressive about connecting users into betas, that's simply not good enough today if you really want to try to tap into the network effect because, you know, at that point they're helping you improve the quality of the product, but they're not really helping you think through the functionality of the product for broad users. And so I think that's how we think about sort of putting the principles of Wikonomics to work is how do we use that model as a way to defend why we need to connect our customers, our users, so early into our thinking about product and innovation. So that by the time it hits the market, a user can look at the product and say, "Yeah, I really see what I contributed to that product." It's, you know, I sometimes joke, and people probably take the joke wrong, but I'll do it anyway. Is, you know, we've all seen ugly babies, but no one has ever had one, and I kind of like that little story because, you know, that is in essence sort of the notion of co-production. When you feel like you gave birth to something, you have an emotional connection to that item, whether it's your child or a product. Of course, to a child, it's going to be a much stronger connection, but the metaphor, I think, holds true. And so how do we enable users, whether you're a soap company or an MP3 company or a software company or an automobile company, whatever kind of company you are, how do you involve your users in the intellectual property production in a way that when the product is shipped, they feel a sense of birthright to what was created? That's a, you know, a holy grail pursuit and definitely a journey, not a destination. But I think is a good way to kind of think about how you might apply the principles of Wikonomics to all of these notions of social computing and word of mouth.
You often talk also about Moore's Law and connectivity and so forth, and how does that relate in your mind in terms of social networking and media and so on?
Well, I guess I think of them as just enablers, right? There are things that have been true for a couple of decades now, is this notion of Moore's Law, you know, contributing to the innovation cycle, and connectivity now certainly changing the dynamics of people's connections via broadband, but also more and more now around mobile. And they're really just providing a way for larger and larger swarms to connect and do what they're already naturally predisposed to do. So if I go back to that sort of Darwinian notion that this is all natural, and that social computing is just a construct that enables people to do what they're already predisposed to do, then I would sort of apply the same logic to what connectivity and Moore's Law is doing. It's simply speeding the pace and enhancing the breadth of the footprint for how many people get to participate in these swarms around ideas. And so maybe they're fuel in the engine of change versus the engine in and of themselves.
You know, I heard you talk about the five P's of social media, and that's people, places, process, platform, and patterns. What is the significance of this in a broader context, and how is it going to impact me in my life?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I played around with, and I was trying to think of a way to sort of describe operationally how a company might think about doing planning for social media, because too often I think, you know, I truly believe that this notion of social media is transformative to a company, meaning, you know, every company essentially does three things. They build stuff, they sell stuff, and they support stuff. Things that are transformational affect all three, or at least two out of three, but I think all three of those functions a company does. And so I think the test of social media is what are its implications across those three business functions. And clearly I'm in the camp that says the notion of mass collaboration will have dramatic impact on all three functions. It'll change how you think about feedback and voice of customer systems and participation of user voice in innovation. It'll certainly change how you think about marketing and word of mouth and participation in the conversation about your product if you do it right. And of course, I've been doing this from a support context personally the last 5 years, and I think it has radical implications for how you think about the support process, because many communities essentially are gigantic supersets of the in-house authored content that you've been building for years, right? Is they have taken and answered millions and millions of questions about how to use your product that you didn't have the foresight, insight, capacity, or whatever to write in your own static content pages. And so they've gone off and innovated in the world around you. So I think that's very transformative. But, you know, as a company looks at this, I think too many of us kind of think about social media as a set of tactics. Is I need to enable RSS feeds, and I need to have a discussion forum, and I need to have an influencer program, and I need to have, you know, a wiki. And we start checking the boxes without sort of understanding the business purpose. And so I wanted to come up with a construct for this, which, you know, for good or whether it's good or not, I guess the audience can judge and send me feedback. But, you know, I came up with this notion of the five P's of social media. And marketers used to have the four P's, and that's still relatively relevant. Yet you had product, place, price, and promotion associated largely in the retail marketing sense. And, you know, and I guess I kind of played off of that a little bit and thought about the five P's of social media being people, place, process, platform, and patterns. I think people is the most important starting point, obviously, because the underlying focus of social media is user contribution, right? Is is the voice of the user in the conversation about how to use products and brands, and or how they're reacting to companies or issues. And that's not all about products and brands. I mean, there's probably no more social media going on about a product than there is about politics today, or social cause, right? So it's pretty much true across the board. But it's not just about the person. It's also about collaboration between people. And so the notion of Wikipedia, I think, is a good example. Is what makes Wikipedia great is that there are an awful lot of subject matter experts collaborating on the quality of the contribution, not just one single user-generated piece of content. So that's the people element of this. In terms of places, you know, I think one of the considerations for a company that is perhaps driven by size or market maturity or even time in terms of criticality is where are the places that these discussions are taking place about our products. You know, for many companies, they have, you know, great discussion areas happening about their products that are within their corporate structure, meaning if you go to www.company.com/discussions, you'll find most of the community discussions about their product. And that's great. That gives you a very focused place to establish your connection with your customers and with your influencers and to have brand dialogue and to look at user-generated content that's valuable to you. And that may be a fine strategy depending on who you are. In Microsoft's case, that strategy just doesn't work. There are far more conversations happening about how to use our products outside Microsoft.com than inside Microsoft.com. And so our strategy has been to cast an exceptionally wide net around how we think about all of the conversations about our products and how we resource ourselves to be in a listening mode and a participation mode across an extremely wide set of discussion and blog areas around the world. Process is the third part of this. Process is probably, you know, maybe the least sexy, but one of the more important pieces of work. It's all well and good to go gather user-generated content, but how do you integrate that back into your core systems and processes? If you go gather user feedback, but you don't tie that back into your existing feedback processes, do your product teams ever hear it? You know, so it's how do you take all of this new media, per se, and tie it back into existing systems and processes in a way that drives business value. Because that's the only way you're going to make it accountable in the system and actually be able to close the loop back with the participants in a way that they feel like they were heard. The platform piece is then sort of, you know, thinking through how to build this stuff, right? Is once you've decided that the conversation matters, how do you build? And, you know, I was at a company several months back, and who I think does really amazing work with their communities, and I won't name them for sake of their privacy and respecting the meeting I was in, but we got to the end of the meeting, and, you know, I was really impressed by what they're doing, but they said, they asked me, because they were under the misguided perception that I'm an expert on social media technologies, but they asked me what was the most important piece of community technology that they should deploy next, that they should be thinking about next, you know, that they had missed. And I thought about that for a minute, and after a moment of panic, I suddenly realized that it was sort of none of the above. There's lots of diamonds to shine and to chase, but the reality is getting the platform right is very critical, and because what you quickly find is you go deploy all this stuff, and you've got wikis and forums and programs, and none of these systems tie together well. And so picking a platform and addressing the integration issues, I actually think, are really critical. For a company is how does your user-generated content model and the system supporting that integrate back in with your in-house generated content model so that those don't look like siloed activities but become integrated over time. So there's a lot of work to do around the platform side of things. Or if you're small or even if you're not small, you may decide that the platform issue isn't for you to build but to go implement inside Facebook. Right, or in MySpace. And there's lots of examples of both large and small companies that are building apps in Facebook and trying to drive from within that platform an outreach strategy for their customers. And that may be appropriate depending on your brand. And the last P, and the one I actually think is the funnest to kind of think through, is patterns. Right, and as a company, the whole reason you do most of this is to do pattern recognition. That's where things get interesting, is how do you start to understand patterns of product usage, patterns of product feedback, patterns of user participation in ways that actually become more valuable business intelligence to tell you about how the products you're building, how to support them, what content is necessary, how to be more engaged with your users, how to better inspire the influencers, and how to better inspire your own employees by all of those conversations happening about your products. Pattern recognition is to me, one of the more emerging parts of this puzzle. Lots of people talk about the notion now of the social graph, and to me, that's that notion of applying the social graph to the five P's of social media. What's interesting about the social graph isn't that it exists. What's interesting is understanding the patterns that exist and the personas that exist inside the graph and understanding how you actually take advantage of that network effect that is present.
It's interesting that you referenced the network effect, and you're talking about Metcalfe. The value is really the square of the nodes involved in the network. So it's interesting how you're tying in these different pieces of research. I find that fascinating.
Well, the network effect, it's one of those age-old things that lots of people have glommed onto and, in essence, laid claim to or been given credit to for. But, a phone was never valuable until there was another phone, right? And every incremental phone added on the planet added more value to the original phone. And I think the same is true of these social networks. Is Facebook wouldn't be of any value if there was one person in it. And I think every incremental person in Facebook brings incremental value to every other user in Facebook or in any social platform. And so the killer feature of social media products or social media services really isn't a UI, it's the people. It's the personas that exist in that network that are actually the killer feature. It's not a UI design issue. Otherwise, we wouldn't all still be using newsgroups as much as we still do today, right? Because I think we could probably agree that Usenet is not the best user experience. But there is a network effect there because there are a lot of people using it. So people find it valuable. They go back again and again.
Microsoft supports the world's largest ecosystem of community in many respects. And you've been talking about the five P's of social media and just really the impact it's having and how it's continued to go, will build out in the future. So what does this all mean to Microsoft, and how will this impact the user experience with Microsoft?
Well, it's a complicated thing, to be honest. But I think it kind of goes back to that business transformation is, I think that for us or for Microsoft, our ability to listen, respond and engage with a much broader set of our users is going up exponentially as these social platforms evolve, right? And I think that's sort of where pretty major impact will happen to us. So, for example, there's lots of specific examples of where you can see change. I'll take the complaint letter or how you think about response management. It used to be not long ago that the complaint process that a company faced was users who had a problem would call your call center or fax you or send you a snail mail letter, and there was some process, hopefully, behind the scenes that managed that and did response back to that customer. That was an important thing, and I think many companies had pretty clear processes in mind for how they would go do that. Today, most companies are finding that process has slowed, not because we have fewer complaints or fewer issues, but because the web has become an open forum to go out and express your frustration on a product or a brand. And, Jeff Jarvis and Del Hell are maybe one of the more famous stories of that, there are tons of examples on the web. And essentially what those public complaints do is they create a platform for every other user who had a valid complaint about the product or brand or company in question. And I think companies have to think really differently about their response management systems to engage in those conversations. The reality is, I guess it would be a great business goal to say, hey, we're never going to have customers who are upset with us. But it's not a very realistic business goal. I don't want to be judged by being fault-free. I want to be judged on my ability to respond. When a user does hit a brick wall with us, what is my commitment to show up in the moment of truth? And I think the expectations are going up, and rightfully so, for how companies of large or small size will differentiate around service for customers when they're having issues with your products. And if you're a marketer, this is a great contact point to listen to this story about as well, because if you're a marketer, I can pretty much assure you that no one talks more about your product than someone who's had a bad customer service experience. Perhaps the only person that actually talks more about your product than someone who has a bad customer service experience is someone who had a bad experience and then you made it right. And so where many companies think of customer service and support as a cost center, I think there's a change on the horizon where you really have to start thinking about customer service and support differently as a competitive differentiator in the marketplace for your product and brand. So I think this is quite transformational for many companies, our own included, to kind of think through what's that next generation response management look like. You know, the feedback process is the same, right? If all these conversations about the product are happening on the web, how do you, especially at our scale where it's literally millions and millions and millions of conversations happening about our products, you know, we can't staff people to go read all those comments. It just is impossible to correlate all that data. And so how will the evolution of semantic web crawling search engines evolve that allow you to start to categorize the sentiment of conversations and start drilling in on customer issues that are either complementary or critical features or functions or business decisions you've made so that you can include those insights into your product planning or policy planning or company planning, communication planning. So lots of opportunities there to change. And you know, I think that there's probably a window of time for some companies to differentiate around how aggressively they engage around this network effect and what's happening in communities. But there'll be a point in time, you know, in the future where this will just be an expected part of how a business connects with its customers. It'll no longer be a differentiator unless you're not doing it. And so I think eventually this is just a great sea change on the way to what is essentially what we're seeing is consumer empowerment, right? Where if you look historically, 30 years ago, manufacturers really controlled the marketplace. You built stuff and you had a lot of control over what was purchased. In much of my childhood in the 80s and the 90s, retail was king. And if I was going to buy something, I went to a retailer and the person behind the counter knew more about the product than I did. Because companies paid to train and build expertise in that model, and that was just the way things work. But on the web today, with user-generated reviews, pretty much I know more about most things I'm interested in than the retailer, if I go into a store at all. And it's not because I'm smarter, it's because I have access to more smart people. It's back to that Wikonomics principle. And so I think there's huge implications to big, you know, both large and small companies. Around what that'll mean to how people interact with your brand. And I think it makes for quite an exciting future when you're a software company and you have users touching your product literally hundreds of billions of times a day, and you get to participate in that and figure out, you know, what the scale challenges are to be the listening system behind that.
Sean, you're the leader behind the most successful award and recognition program. In all of the sort of research that you've done in social media, social networking, and Gen Y, and swarm theory, and so forth, how does this apply to the MVP program? What does it mean to people who get this designation or to the program itself, and how it builds out into the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things we'll see. I mean, I've certainly experienced over the last 6 months in particular that an awful lot of companies are thinking through this notion of what an influencer program is. And so I think if I was an MVP today, one of the things that I might expect is a great deal of emulation of companies trying to figure out what the influence model is. You know, and in fact, just this week, somebody sent me a news release that I think it's the New York Knicks or one of the New York sports franchises just announced an influencer program this week. Nike announced a new program a few weeks ago, right? So it's not just about the software industry thinking about this influence effect, but lots of companies trying to figure out the influence effect. And everybody's kind of swarming around this notion of, is it the influencer or is it the network that is the value to interact with? And, you know, it's probably not an either or, it's probably both. But from my point of view, I think that the influencer is incredibly critical in this process. And I guess the way I would describe what we've done that I think is right versus what we've seen others do and we will continue to see others do that probably isn't right is what I would describe as the difference between an influencer program and a loyalty program. A loyalty program is essentially a find and thank program, right? Is you go out and find people that use your products a lot, and you thank them through some sort of mechanism. And that's a great thing to do, to be honest. I actually wouldn't stand here and say that, you know, that that's a bad business practice. It's a fine business practice, but it's not an influencer program. It's not something that's going to feed the network effect, right? A real influencer program has to be about finding, thanking, and engaging. And where I see the difference between where our ambitions are and what I hope others' ambitions are who think about this discipline is, you know, the fallacy that the model might be, you know, person A tells person B, the influencer, some piece of information, believing that person B is going to go tell their network everything that they just said. And essentially what I just described there is the viral marketing model, right? Is where the business strategy is we're going to have something compelling to say, and we're going to go tell somebody, and that person's going to tell the world. And we're going to get some sort of acceleration through that model because of the quality of our message. And and lots of companies have had some success in viral marketing. But, you know, there's no baseball team that whose business strategy for winning the World Series is we're going to bat 1,000 this year, right? It's a bad business strategy to assume you're going to bat 1,000. And I tend to feel like viral marketing is sort of it's a batting average sort of game. So I don't really, while it's great if it happens, I don't really believe in the model all that much. I'm much more interested in the influencer effect, where the reality is person A tells person B something, and then they listen to person B. Person B starts telling person A something, and something changes in that conversation, you know, and as the company, if you're A, you're either making a change because you got some feedback, or you're not making a change, but you're explaining to person B why you're not making that change so they understand your decision. But there's a dialogue that's occurring between the influencer and the company or the product in question. And it's that conversation that actually, I think, creates integrity or authenticity in whatever person B will go out and say in the network. It might not be always positive what they go say, but it is authentic. And so I think that's what I guess we aspire to from an MVP program standpoint, is how do we continue to focus not on the thank, on the find and thank, but on continuing to deepen the engagement part of the equation. Because it's really the discussion between those leaders and us and how we think about our innovation that has the potential to drive authentic conversation between them and users on the web. And whatever they say, they'll say. And you know, that's where authenticity rings true. And hopefully that'll turn out good for us. But in the end, I think the more that we enable them to be a part of the process, the better off we'll be and the more interested they'll be.
You know, it's interesting. How would you define Microsoft? Would you say you're a product company, a community company, a consumer company, a gaming company?
Well, maybe we're all of those things. I mean, we're a software company. We're a company that, whose aspiration is, you know, literally, I mean, not to play on the slogan, but whose aspiration is to help people realize their potential. But, you know, if you peel that back, everybody has a different motivation out there around what they're trying to accomplish with technology or utilizing technology to achieve another aspiration. And, you know, our hope is that people find ways that they're inspired by us, inspired by our products, inspired by their fellow users, in ways to get more out of what they're trying to accomplish in whatever their daily or evening ritual might be, whether you're a passionate gamer and, you know, my daughter just started playing Guitar Hero, and, you know, she's better than me already, which is disturbing. But, you know, whatever that aspiration is, that you should be able to achieve it. And so if we're going to be successful at that, I think community is an extremely necessary part of it, because in the end, you know, we're a small company. People think we're a large company, and I guess in relative terms we are, but we're 80,000 people with approaching a billion customers or users. 80,000 doesn't scale very well in that model. So unless we can inspire user-to-user conversations that empowers people to get more from the technology, we just simply can't be successful. And so that's what I think is quite exciting about this emergent trend.
So where do I go to find out more about this trend and where it's going to build out into the future? What can I put into my live search window?
Yeah, I mean, you could go search on Web 2.0 and you'd probably get a quarter billion hits. I'm actually a fan of using social bookmarking sites like Delicious to research some of this stuff. Certainly, people are welcome to read my blog. You know, so if you go to www.communitygrouptherapy.com or search on my name, you'll find it fairly easily. You know, and hopefully people will like what I have to say about it. But probably even more valuable than that is there's a link. There's a set of links on my website that take you off to some of the other people that I think are great thought leaders on this topic that I spend an awful lot of time talking to and reading what they have to say. And pretty much everything I read that I think is really interesting or insightful, I do tag in Delicious. So people can find me in Delicious at Sean O'D, MVP. I also federate that Delicious tag cloud back to my blog, so people can see what I'm reading there. So there's lots of different ways to get information, but you know, I think you know the blogosphere is a good place to start. And you know, I don't want to make any claims about the my blog personally in all of that being the best or the worst. But certainly, some of the people I follow and some of my links, I think, are really very insightful on the topic. And I encourage people to crawl and see what they find.
Sean, your insights are sort of legendary because you do so much reading, so much research, and your background is so diverse in terms of your interests. So taking that all into consideration, what are your predictions in terms of future trends, and what are the implications and opportunities?
Well, I wish I knew. I wish I was a better predictor. You know, a couple of things kind of come to mind that I think are fascinating to watch, and I think they're happening at a very fast pace. One is this emergence of personal brands. You know, the blogosphere kind of gave birth in some ways to the person as the brand versus the company or the product as the brand. And I think that's quite an interesting emergent trend that kind of ties back to the technology, but it also ties back to an emerging work style amongst those Gen Y arrivals on the scene. Is I think we all need to be thinking about what is our personal brand on the web. If somebody does a live search or Google search on my name, what do they find? Do they find party photos? Do they find my blog? What do they discover about me? And how do I feel about what they discover about me? And do I feel it appropriately represents who I want to be on the web? Is an important thing. Does my resume matter, or is it just a tool because the hiring manager is going to do a search on my name? And so I think this whole issue of personal brands and people thinking about very much more intentionally about who and what they are is probably more and more important. I think privacy is an interesting thing to watch. You know, I've always sort of known that I was less fearful of privacy issues than my parents, for example. You know, my parents, who really still won't do e-commerce on the web at all, and I do probably the vast majority of my buying on the web. You know, it's just a difference in generational difference that is relatively understandable. And I think we're seeing the same thing between people who are my age and those that are emerging out of the MySpace generation or Gen Y. Is there's a whole different level of thought around what privacy means and what does public disclosure mean. And, you know, we can sit back and think that's good or bad, but the reality is it is what's happening. And so I think that has interesting implications in the future. You know, one of them is this redefinition of the word friend. What is a friend? I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's you know, friend meant something really different a few years ago. Whereas today, I have 700 friends in Facebook. I kind of wish I could manage those friends a little bit differently than Facebook allows me to do today. But I don't know all of them as intimately as I know my best friend. But in some of these social networks, they all have equal status. So I think that's interesting. I've heard bloggers refer to people they know as their friends, and I know for a fact they've never met. Or you hear, you know, 2 years ago somebody said that they met their fiance at Match.com. You know, you can't tell me that a number of people in the room might have a reaction to that story that wasn't 100% positive, because there were certain perceptions about online dating. But I think now, only 2 years later, that's completely different. I don't even think people would bat an eye about it today. And in that scenario, you're talking about one of the most personal decisions in the world that people make. And so that's astounding cultural change phenomena occurring at a scary rate. So I think it's hazardous to predict the future other than to say that this notion of social computing, while there may be some bubble around tools and technologies and social sites, the trend itself is clear, and I think it will have radical implications on organizational design, organizational structure, product design, product cycles, how people interact. I think all of these things are going to change, and it's going to be quite interesting, I think, to kind of watch how it affects society and our participation in it. So, I don't know if that's all that prescriptive. I guess you couldn't make very many investment choices based upon that advice, but those are some things that I think are interesting to watch, and I'll certainly keep a pulse on as much as I can.
So I'm going to turn the tables here, and I'm going to say you're the interviewer, but you're interviewing yourself. What questions would you ask of yourself if you were the interviewer, and what would be your answers?
Jeez, I should have prepared for that. I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, the more interesting questions in some ways for me are maybe one that I would point at. One is, how do you connect all of this enthusiasm, right? There's massive discussion and enthusiasm out there for this work, this social computing work. There's tons of buzz about social computing, social networks, Facebook, all this technology. But I still think there's a lot of open questions about, okay, great, there's all this enthusiasm. How do you connect that enthusiasm back to business value if you're a corporation, large or small? And I think that's where, you know, really interesting work still has to be done. It's one thing to be enthusiastic about it and have this feeling that it's right and it's important. It's quite another thing to walk into a chief executive officer in whatever size your company is and have budget requests to go out and make fundamental investments in blogging or in forum development or in social media monitoring and be asked what the ROI model looks like and realize that there's still a lot of work to be done. And so, you know, I guess that's one of the areas. And I guess, you know, where the answer for me is a little bit is I would go back to that story of influence across the product cycle where, you know, you really have to look at not just the marketing value proposition, because I think looking only there will lead you to a very difficult proof path, but looking at the innovation process, the sales and marketing process, and the support and service process, and really thinking through what the ROI model is across all three of those business functions for any investment you might be making in social media. Because until you're looking at all three functions, one, I don't think you'll build the most robust ROI model that you can. And two, I don't think you'll actually realize the potential of the model, because if it's not affecting your innovation, you won't get as strong a network effect as you potentially could. And so that's probably where I would spend more of my energy, and in the place I spend a lot of my time today is really thinking about how do I connect all of this enthusiasm to business value propositions that people who don't live in Facebook every day, necessarily understand or necessarily are empowered to make decisions that are just emotion driven. So that'd be one place I'd spend some time thinking.
Well, Sean, you know, you're incredibly connected, and you make yourself so accessible in so many different ways. So I really do appreciate the time you've spent with us, sharing your ideas, your insights, and discussing all of the things that are happening that are so exciting and driving so much passion in the world and in communities. Again, very much appreciated you coming in to do this interview.
My pleasure. It's, it's not something I have any lack of energy to talk about, And to be honest, I do think it's kind of the only way you really understand this phenomena and overcome that translation effect problem between enthusiasm and business value is you've got to sit down and talk it through and start to verbalize or write what it is you think is important to do, because it's really the only way to codify your belief system in it beyond just the emotional level. And so I have a fun time doing these things, and if anyone listens and thinks it was good, great. I love that. And probably the best feedback anybody could ever give me would be to grab my RSS feed on my blog. I guess that's probably the most tangible way to give me feedback.
Well, I would definitely encourage that because, again, you are a thought leader, and there's literally millions around the world who read your ideas, and you do all the research, so you're crunching all the information for people and giving them this sort of deep insights and a condensed version of what to look at and how to sort of examine what's happening out there. So, again, very much appreciated, and thank you.